my approach and stepped forward to greet me.
"Ah, young sir," he said, holding out his hand. "My name is Kairva. Might I ask?"
"I need a horse," I said, shaking his hand quickly. "Healthy, well-rested, and well-fed, one that can take 6 hours of hard riding today."
"Certainly, certainly," Kairva said, rubbing his hands together and nodding. "All things are possible with the will of God. I'd be pleased to—"
"Listen," I interrupted again. "I'm in a hurry, so we're going to skip the preliminaries. I won't pretend to be uninterested. You won't waste my time with a parade of hacks and nags. If I have not bought a horse in 10 minutes, I will leave and buy one elsewhere." I met his eye. "Linsatva?" The Kildish man was aghast.
"Sir, the purchase of a horse should never be so rushed. You would not pick a wife in 10 minutes, and on the road a horse is more important than a wife."
He gave a bashful smile.
"Even God himself didn't—"
I cut him off yet again. "God's not buying a horse today. I am." The thin Kildish man paused to collect his thoughts.
"Right,"
he said softly, more to himself than to me. "Lin, come around and see what we have." He led me around the outside of the stables to a small corral. He gestured near the edge of the fence.
"That dapple mare is as steady a horse as any you could hope for. She'll take you—"
I ignored him and looked over the half-dozen hacks that stood idly inside the fence. Though I had neither means nor reason to keep a horse, I knew good from bad, and nothing I saw here came close to suiting my needs. You see, troopers live and die by the horses that pull their wagons, and my parents had not neglected my education in this area. I could size up a horse by the time I was 8, and a good thing too. Townsfolk regularly tried to pass off half-dead or gingered-up nags to us, knowing that by the time we discovered our mistakes, we'd be miles and days away. There was a world of trouble waiting for a man who sold his neighbour some sickly hobble, but what was the harm of swindling one of the filthy, thieving roo? I turned to face the cavalier, frowning. "You've just wasted 2 precious minutes of my time, so I'm guessing you still don't understand my position here. Let me be as plain as possible. I want a fast horse ready for hard riding today. For this, I will pay quickly, in hard coin, and without complaint." I held up my newly heavy purse in one hand and shook it, knowing he could tell the ring of true Kildish silver inside. "If you sell me a horse that throws a shoe, or starts to limp, or spooks at shadows, I will miss a valuable opportunity, a quite unrecoverable opportunity. If that happens, I will not come back and demand a refund. I will not petition the constable. I will walk back to Imray this very night and set fire to your house. Then, when you run out of the front door in your nightshirt and stockle cap, I will kill you, cook you, and eat you, right there, on your lawn, while all your neighbours watch." I gave him a deadly serious look. "This is the business arrangement I am proposing, Kairva. If you're not comfortable with it, tell me, and I will go elsewhere. Otherwise, leave off this parade of drays and show me a real horse." The short keeled looked at me, more stunned than horrified. I could see him trying to come to grips with the situation. He must think I was either a raving lunatic or the son of some important noble, or both. "Very well," he said, letting all the ingratiating charm fall from his voice.
"When you say hard riding, how hard do you mean?"
"Very hard," I said. "I need to go 70 miles today, dirt roads."
"Will you need saddle and tack too?"
I nodded. "Nothing fancy, nothing new." He drew a deep breath.
"Fine. And how much do you have to spend?"
I shook my head and gave a tight smile. "Show me the horse, and name your price. A Volda would do nicely. If he's a little wild, I won't mind if it means he's got energy to spare. Even a good Volda mix could serve me. Or a Kershen fourth horse." Kaeva nodded and led me back towards the wide doors of the stable.
"I do have a Kershen, a full blood, actually."
He made a gesture to one of the stable hands.
"Bring out our black gentleman, double quick."
The boy sprinted off. The cavalier turned back to me.
"Gorgeous animal. I ran him through the traces before I bought him, just to be sure. Galloped him a full mile, and he hardly even worked up a sweat. Smooth a gait as ever I felt, and
I'd not lie to your lordship on that account.
I nodded. A full-blooded Cairshean was exactly suited to my purpose. They had a legendary endurance, but there would be no avoiding the price either. A well-trained fourth horse was worth a dozen talents.
How much are you asking for him?
I want 2 solid marks,
he said without any hint of apology or wheedling in his voice. Merciful Taylor, 20 talents. He'd have to have silver shoes to be worth that much.
I'm in no mood for a lengthy dicker, Kyover, I said shortly.
You've made me well aware of that, my lord, he said. I'm telling you my honest price. Here, you'll see why.
The boy hurried out, leading a sleek monster of a horse. At least 18 hands tall, proud head and black from his nose to the tip of his tail.
He loves to run,
Kyova said with genuine affection in his voice. He ran a hand along the smooth black neck.
And look at that colour. Not so much as a pale whisker. That's why he's worth 20 if he's worth a single shim.
I don't care about the colour, I said absent-mindedly, while I looked him over for signs of injury or old age. There was nothing. He was glossy, young, strong. I just need to move quickly.
I understand, he said apologetically, but I can't just ignore the colouring. If I wait a span or two, some young lord will pay just for the snappy look of him.
I knew it was true.
Does he have a name?
I asked, moving slowly towards the black horse, letting him smell my hands and get used to me. Bargaining can be hurried, but befriending a horse cannot. Only a fool rushes first impressions with a spirited young Cairshean.
Not one that's stuck on him, he said. What's your name, boy?
I asked gently, just so he could get used to the sound of my voice. He snuffed delicately at my hand, keeping close watch with one large, intelligent eye. He didn't back away, but he certainly wasn't at his ease either. I kept talking as I came closer, hoping he would relax at the sound of my voice.
You deserve a good name.
I hate to see some lordling with delusions of wit saddle you with some terrible name like Midnight or Sooty or Scut. I came closer and lay one hand along his neck. His skin twitched, but he didn't pull away. I needed to be sure of his temperament as much as his stamina. I couldn't take the risk of jumping on the back of a skittish horse.
Someone half clever might dub you Pitch or Scuttle, ill-favoured names. Or Slate, a sedentary name, heaven forbid you end up Blackie. That's an ill-fitting name for a prince like you.
My father always talked to new horses in this way, in a steady, calming litany. As I stroked his neck, I kept speaking without giving any mind to what I said. Words don't matter to the horse. The tone of your voice is the important thing.
You've come a long way. You should have a proud name so folk won't think of you as common. Was your previous owner Kildish?
I asked.
Vevuanaloi tuteriam keta palante.
I could sense him relax a bit at the sound of the familiar language. I walked on to his other side, still looking him over carefully and letting him get used to my presence.
Tuketa?
I asked him.
Are you cold? Tumane?
Are you a shadow? I wanted to say twilight, but I couldn't bring the Siaru word to mind. Rather than pause, I just bulled ahead, faking it as best I could as I eyed his hooves to see if they were chipped or cracked.
Tuketzalhan? Are you first night?
The big black lowered his head and nuzzled me. You like that one, do you? I said with a bit of a laugh, knowing that what really happened was that he had caught scent of the package of dried apple I had tucked in one of the pockets of my cloak. The important thing was that he had a feel for me now. If he was comfortable enough to nuzzle at me for food, we could get along well enough for a hard day's ride. Kethsalan seems to suit him for a name, I said, turning back to Kaerva. Anything else I need to know?
Kaerva seemed disconcerted. He shies a bit on his right side.
A bit?
Just a bit. It stands to reason that he's probably a bit prone to spooking on that side too, but I haven't seen him do it.
How's he trained? Close rein or trooper style?
Close.
Fine. You've got 1 minute left to make this deal. He's a good animal, but I'm not paying 20 talents for him. I spoke with certainty in my voice, but no hope in my heart. He was a gorgeous animal, and his colouring made him worth at least 20 talents. Still, I'd go through the motions and hope to squeeze the man down to 19. That at least would leave me money for food and lodging when I got to Trayvon.
Very well,
Kaeva said. 16. Only my years of stage training kept me from gaping openly at his sudden drop. 15, I said, feigning irritation, and that will include the saddle tack and a bag of oats. I began pulling money out of my purse as if the deal was already finished. Unbelievably, Kaeva nodded and called for one of the boys to bring a saddle and tack. I counted the money into Kaeva's hand as his assistant saddled the big black. The keeled seemed uncomfortable, meeting my eye. If I didn't know horses as well as I do, I would have thought I was being swindled. Maybe the horse was stolen, or the man was desperate for money. Whatever the reason, I didn't care. I was due a bit of good luck. Best of all, this meant that I might be able to resell the horse at a bit of a profit after I reached Trayvon. Honestly, I would need to sell him as soon as I could manage, even if I lost money on the deal. Stabling, food, and grooming for a horse like this would cost me a penny a day. I couldn't afford to keep him. I strapped my travel sack into a saddlebag, checked the cinch and stirrups, then swung myself up onto Kate Selan's back. He danced slightly to the right, eager to be off. That made two of us. I twitched the reins, and we were on our way. Most problems with horses have nothing to do with the horses themselves. They stem from the ignorance of the rider. Folk shoe their horses badly, saddle them improperly, feed them poorly, then complain that they were sold a half-lame, swayback, ill-tempered hack. I knew horses. My parents had taught me to ride and care for them. While most of my experience had been with sturdier breeds, bred to pull rather than to race, I knew how to cover ground quickly when I needed to. When they're in a hurry, most folk push their mount too hard too soon. They head out at a dead gallop, then find themselves with a horse lame or half dead inside an hour. Pure idiocy. Only a 12-color bastard treats a horse that way. But to be entirely truthful, I would have ridden Quetzalan to death if it would have brought me to Trayvon in a timely fashion. There are some times when I am willing to be a bastard. I would have killed a dozen horses if it would have helped me get more information about the Chandrian and why they had killed my parents. But ultimately, there was no sense in thinking that way. A dead horse wouldn't get me to Trayvon. A live one would. So I started Keth Salhan at a nice walk to warm him up. He was eager to go faster, probably sensing my own impatience, and that would have been fine if I'd only needed to go a mile or three, but I needed him for at least 50, maybe 70, and that meant patience. I had to rein him back down to a walk twice before he resigned himself to it. After a mile, I trotted him for a bit. His gait was smooth, even for a Kershian, but a trot is jarring no matter what, and it pulled at the new stitches in my side. I urged him up to a canter after another mile or so. Only after we were 3 or 4 miles out of Imre and we came to a good straight stretch of flat road did I nudge him up to a gallop. Finally, given the chance to run, he surged ahead. The sun had just finished burning away the morning dew, and farmers harvesting wheat and barley in the fields looked up as we thundered past. Quetzalan was fast, so fast that the wind tore at my cloak, stretching it behind me like a flag. Despite the fact that I knew I must cut quite the dramatic figure, I quickly grew tired of the drag on my neck, unfastened the cloak, then stuffed it into a saddlebag. When we passed through a stand of trees, I brought Selan back down to a trot. That way, he got a little rest and we didn't run the risk of rounding a corner and barreling into a fallen tree or slow-moving cart. When we came out into pasture land and could see our way clear, I gave him his head again, and we practically flew. After an hour and a half of this, Selan was sweating and breathing hard, but he was doing better than I was. My legs were a rubbery mess. I was fit enough and young, but I hadn't been in a saddle for years. Riding uses different muscles than walking,
and riding at a gallop is just as hard as running unless you want to make your horse work twice as hard for every mile. Suffice to say, I welcomed the next stretch of trees. I hopped out of the saddle and walked to give both of us a well-deserved break. I cut one of my apples down the middle and gave him the larger half. I figured we'd come about 30 miles, and the sun wasn't even fully at zenith.
"That's the easy bit," I told him, stroking his neck fondly. "Lord, but you're lovely. You're not half blown yet, are you?"
We walked for about 10 minutes. Then we had the good luck to come across a little creek with a wooden bridge running across it. I let him drink for a long minute, then pulled him away before he took too much. Then I mounted up and gated him back up to a gallop by slow stages. My legs burned and ached as I leaned over his neck. The drumming of his hooves was like a counterpoint to the slow song of the wind, endlessly burning past my ears. The first snag came about an hour later when we had to cross a wide stream. It wasn't treacherous by any means, but I had to unsaddle him and carry everything across rather than risk it getting wet. I couldn't ride him for hours wearing a wet harness. On the other side of the river, I dried him off with my blanket and resaddled him. It took half an hour, which meant he had gone from being rested to being cold, so I had to warm him up gently, slow walk to trot to canter. That stream cost me an hour, all told. I worried if there was another one, the chill would get into Selan's muscles. If that happened, Talu himself wouldn't be able to bring him up to a gallop again. An hour later, I passed through a small town, hardly more than a church and a tavern, that happened to be next to each other. I stopped long enough to let Selan drink a bit from a trough. I stretched my numb legs and looked up anxiously at the sun. After that, the fields and farms grew fewer and farther between. The trees grew thicker and denser. The road narrowed and was not in good repair, rocky in places, washed out in others. It made for slower and slower going. But truth be told, neither myself or Keth Selan had much more galloping left in us. Eventually, we came to another stream crossing the road. Not much more than a foot deep, most. The water had a sharp, foul smell that let me know there was a tannery upstream or a refinery. There wasn't any bridge, and Keth Selan made his way slowly across, placing his hooves gingerly on the rocky bottom. I wondered idly if it felt good, like when you dangle your feet in the water after a long day's walking. The stream didn't slow us down much, but over the next half hour we had to cross it 3 separate times as it wound back and forth across the road. It was an inconvenience more than anything, never much deeper than 1.5 feet. Each time we crossed it, the acrid smell of the water was worse, solvents and acids, if not a refinery, then at least a mine. I kept my hands on the reins, ready to pull Selan's head up if he tried to drink. But he was smarter than that. A long canter later, I came up over a hill and looked down onto a crossroads at the bottom of a small grassy valley. Right under the signpost was a tinker with a pair of donkeys, one of them loaded so high with bags and bundles that it looked ready to tip over, the other conspicuously unburdened. It stood by the side of the dirt road, grazing with a small mountain of gear piled beside it. The tinker sat on a small stool at the side of the road, looking dispirited. His expression brightened when he saw me riding down the hill. I read the signpost as I came closer. North was Trebon, south was Temfalls. I reined in as I approached. Keth Selan and I could both use the rest, and I was not in enough of a hurry to be rude to a tinker, not by half. If nothing else, the fellow could tell me how far I had left to go before I came to Trebon.
"Hello there,"
he said, looking up at me, shading his eyes with one hand.
"You got the look of a lad that's wanting something?"
He was older, balding, with a round, friendly face. I laughed. "I'm wanting a lot of things, Tinker, but I don't think you've got any of them in your packs." He gave me an ingratiating smile.
"Well, no, don't go assuming."
He stopped and looked down for a moment thoughtfully. When he met my eyes again, his expression was still kind, but more serious than before.
"Listen, I'll be honest with you, son. My little donkey has got herself a stone bruise in her forehoof and can't carry her load. I'm stuck here until I come by some manner of help.
Normally nothing would make me happier than to help you, Tinker, I said, but I need to get to Trebon as quickly as I can.
That won't take much doing.
He nodded over the hill to the north.
You're only about a half mile out. If the wind was blowing southerly, you could smell the smoke.
I looked in the direction he gestured, and saw chimney smoke rising from behind the hill. A great wave of relief washed over me. I'd made it, and it was barely an hour after noon. The tinker continued.
I need to get to the Evestown docks,
he nodded to the east.
I've made arrangements to ship down river, and I'd dearly love to catch my boat.
He eyed my horse significantly.
But I need a new pack animal to carry my gear.
It seems my luck had finally turned. Selan was a fine horse, but now that I was in Trebon, he would be little more than a constant drain on my limited resources. Still, it's never wise to look eager to sell. This is an awful lot of horse to be used for packing, I said, patting Ketzelhan's neck. He's a full-blooded Cairshean, and I can tell you I've never seen a better horse in all my days. The tinker looked him over skeptically.
He's knackered is what he is, he said. He hasn't got another mile left in him.
I swung off the saddle, staggering a bit when my rubbery legs almost buckled underneath me.
You should give him some credit, Tinker. He's come all the way from Imray today.
The tinker chuckled.
Oh, you're not a bad liar, boy, but you need to know when to stop if the bait's too big the fish won't bite.
I didn't need to pretend to be horrified.
I'm sorry I didn't properly introduce myself, I held out my hand. My name is Quoth. I am a trooper and one of the Ademaru. Never on my most desperate day would I lie to a tinker.
The tinker shook my hand.
Well,
he said, slightly taken aback.
My sincere apologies to you and your family. It's rare to see one of your folk alone on the road.
He looked the horse over critically.
All the way from Imray, you say?
I nodded.
That's what, almost 60 miles. Hell of a ride.
He looked at me with a knowing smile.
How are your legs?
I grinned back at him.
Let's just say I'll be glad to be on my feet again. He's good for another 10 miles, I guess, but I can't say the same for myself.
The tinker looked over the horse again and gave a gusty sigh.
Well, as I sit, you've got me over a bit of a barrel. How much do you want for him?
Well, I said, Ketzelan here's a full-blood Cairshean, and his colour is lovely, you have to admit. Not a patch on him, but isn't black. Not a white whisker.
The tinker burst out laughing.
Ho, 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 I take it back,
he said.
You're a terrible liar.
I don't see what's so funny, I said a little stiffly. The tinker gave me an odd look.
Not a white whisker, no.
He nodded past me towards Salan's hindquarters.
But if he's all black, then I'm Aran Velsito.
I turned to look, and saw that Keth Salan's left hind foot had a distinct white sock that went halfway up to his hock. Stupefied, I walked back and bent down to look. It wasn't a clean white, more of a washed-out grey. I could smell the faint odour of the stream we had splashed through on the last leg of our journey. Solvents.
That shim bastard, I said incredulously. He sold me a dyed horse.
Didn't the name tip you off?
The tinker chuckled.
Ketzelan, lad boy, someone's been thumbing your nose at you.
His name means twilight, I said.
The tinker shook his head.
Your siaru is rusty. Ketzelem would be first night. Selan means suck. His name is One Suck.
I thought back to the horse trader's reaction when I'd picked the name. No wonder the fellow had seemed so disconcerted. No wonder he had dropped the price so quickly and easily. He thought I knew his little secret. The tinker laughed at my expression and clapped me on the back.
Oh, don't sweat it, lad. It happens to the best of us from time to time.
He turned away and began to rummage through his bundles.
I think I have something you like. Let me offer you a trade.
He turned around and held out something black and gnarled like a piece of driftwood. I took it from him and looked it over. It was heavy and cold to the touch. "A lump of slag iron," I said. "Are you out of magic beans?" The tinker held out a pin in his other hand. He held it about a handspan away, then let go. Instead of falling, the pin snapped to the side and clung to the smooth blob of black iron. I drew in an appreciative breath. "A lodestone? I've never seen one of these."
"Technically, it's a Trebanstone," he said matter-of-factly, "as it's never been near Loden, but you're near enough. There's all manner of people who would be interested in that beauty down Imre way."
I nodded absently as I turned it over in my hands. I'd always wanted to see a drawstone, ever since I was a child. I pulled the pin away, feeling the strange attraction it had to smooth black metal. I marveled. A piece of star iron in my hand. "How much do you figure it's worth?" I asked. The tinker sucked his teeth a little.
"Well, I'm figuring right here and now it's worth just about one full-blooded Cairnsean pack mule."
I turned it over in my hand, pulled the pin away and let it snap back again. "Trouble is, Tinker, I put myself into debt with a dangerous woman in order to buy this horse. If I don't sell it well, I'm going to be in a desperate way." He nodded.
"Piece of sky iron of that size. If you take less than 18 talents, you're cutting a hole in your own purse. Jewelers will buy it, or rich folk who want it for the novelty."
He tapped the side of his nose.
"But if you head to the university, you'll do better. Artificers have a great love for lodestone. Alchemists, too. If you find one in the right mood, you'll get more."
It was a good deal. Manet had taught me lodestone was quite valuable and difficult to come by, not only for its galvanic properties, but because pieces of sky iron like this often had rare metals mingled with the iron. I held out my hand. "I'm willing to make it a deal." We shook hands solemnly. Then, just as the tinker began to reach for the reins, I asked, "And what will you give me for his tack and saddle?" I was a little worried that the tinker might take offense at my wheedling, but instead, he smiled a sly smile.
"That's a clever lad," he chuckled. "I like a fellow who's not afraid to push for a little extra. What would you like, then? I've got a lovely woolen blanket here, or some nice rope."
He pulled a coil of it out of the donkey's packs.
"Always good to have a piece of rope with you. How about this?"
He turned around with a bottle in his hands and winked at me.
"I've got some lovely Avonish fruit wine. I'd give you all 3 for your horse's gear."
"I could use a spare blanket," I admitted. Then a thought occurred to me. "Do you have any clothes near my size? I seem to be going through a lot of shirts lately." The old man paused, holding the rope and bottle of wine, then shrugged and began to dig around in his packs. "Have you heard anything about a wedding around these parts?" I asked. Tinkers always have their ears to the ground.
"The Martin wedding."
He tied off one pack and began to dig through another.
"I hate to tell you, but you missed it. Happened yesterday."
My stomach clenched at his casual tone. If there had been a massacre, the tinker would certainly have heard. I suddenly had the horrible thought that I'd put myself in debt and run halfway to the mountains on a goose chase. "Were you there? Did anything odd happen?"
"Here we are,"
the tinker turned around, holding up a shirt of plain grey homespun.
"Nothing fancy, I'm afraid, but it's new. Well, newish."
He held it up to my chest to judge the fit.
"The wedding?"
I prompted.
"What? Oh, no, I wasn't there. Bit of an event, though, from what I understand. Martin's only daughter and they were sending her off proper, been planning it for months."
"So you didn't hear of anything odd happening?" I asked, a sinking feeling in my gut. He shrugged helplessly.
"Like I said, I wasn't there. I've been up around the ironworks the last couple of days."
He nodded to the west.
"Trading with panners and folk up in the High Rock."
He tapped the side of his head as if he just remembered something.
"That reminds me. I found a brassy up in the hills."
He rummaged in his packs again and brought out a flat, thick bottle.
"If you don't care for wine, maybe something a little stronger."
I started to shake my head, then realized that some homemade bran would be useful cleaning my side tonight.
"I might be," I said, "depending on the offer on the table."
"Honest young gent like yourself,"
he said grandly. I'll give you a blanket, both bottles, and the coil of rope.
You're generous, Tinker, but I'd rather have the shirt than the rope and the fruit wine. They'd just be dead weight in my bag, and I've got a lot of walking ahead of me.
His expression soured a little, but he shrugged.
Your call, of course. Blanket, short, brand, and three jots.
We shook hands, and I took time to help him load Quetzalan because I had the vague feeling that I'd insulted him by turning down his previous offer. 10 minutes later, he was heading east, and I made my way north over the green hills into Trebon. I was glad to walk the last half mile under my own power, as it helped me work the stiffness from my legs and back. As I crested the hill, I saw Trebon sprawling out below, tucked into a low bowl made by the hills. It wasn't a large town by any means, perhaps 100 buildings sprawling around a dozen winding, packed dirt streets. In the early days, with the troop, I'd learned how to size up a town. It's a lot like reading your audience when you're playing in a tavern. The stakes are higher, of course. Play the wrong song in a tavern and people might hiss you, but misjudge an entire town and things can get uglier than that. So I sized up Trebon. It was off the beaten path, halfway between a mining town and a farming town. They weren't likely to be instantly suspicious of strangers, but it was small enough that everyone knew by looking at you that you weren't one of the locals. I was surprised to see people setting up straw-stuffed shamble men outside their homes. That meant that despite the proximity to Imre and the university, Trebon was truly a backwater community. Every town has a harvest festival of some sort, but these days most folk settle for having a bonfire and getting drunk. The fact that they were following old folk traditions meant people in Trebon were more superstitious than I would usually expect. Despite that, I liked seeing the shamble men. I have a fondness for the traditional harvest festivals, superstitions and all. They're a type of theatre, really. The Tailin Church was the nicest building in town, 3 stories tall and made of quarried stone. Nothing odd about that, but bolted above the front doors, high above the ground, was one of the biggest iron wheels I'd ever seen. It was real iron, too, not just painted wood. It was 10 feet tall and must have weighed a solid ton. Ordinarily, such a display would have made me nervous, but since Trebon was a mining town, I guessed it showed civic pride more than fanatic piety. Most of the other buildings in town were low to the ground, built of rough timber with cedar shingle roofs. The inn was respectable, though, 2 stories tall with plaster walls and red clay tiles on the roof. There was bound to be someone in there who would know more about the wedding. There was a bare handful of people inside, not surprising as harvest was in full swing, and there were still 5 or 6 hours of good daylight left. I put on my best anxious expression as I made my way over to the bar where the innkeeper stood.
Excuse me, I said. I hate to trouble you, but I'm looking for someone.
The innkeeper was a dark-haired man with a perpetual scowl.
Who's that, then?
My cousin was here for a wedding, I said, and I heard there was some trouble.
At the word wedding, the innkeeper's scowl turned stony. I could feel the 2 men farther down the bar, not looking at me, pointedly, not looking anywhere in my direction. It was true, then. Something terrible had happened. I saw the innkeeper reach out and press his fingers onto the bar. It took me a second to realize he was touching the iron head of a nail driven into the wood.
Bad business, he said shortly. Nothing I care to say about it.
Please,
I said, letting worry bleed into my tone.
I was visiting family in Temples when the rumour came down that something had happened. They're all busy pulling in the last of the wheat, so I promised I'd come up and see what the trouble was.
The innkeeper looked me up and down. A gawker, he could turn away, but he couldn't deny me the right to know what had happened to a family member.
There's the one upstairs who was there, he said shortly.
Not from around here. Might be your cousin.
A witness?
I opened my mouth to ask another question, but he shook his head.
I don't know a thing about it, he said firmly. Don't care to either.
He turned and made himself suddenly busy with the taps of his beer barrels.
Up at the far end of the road, on the left.
I headed across the room and up the stairs. I could feel everyone not looking at me now. Their silence and the innkeeper's tone made it clear that whoever was upstairs was not one of the many who had been there. It was the one. One survivor. I went to the end of the hallway and knocked on the door. First softly, then again louder. I opened the door slowly so as not to startle whoever might be inside. It was a narrow room with a narrow bed. A woman lay on it, fully clothed, one arm wrapped in a bandage. Her head was turned towards the window, so I could only see her profile. Still, I recognized her. Denna. I must have made some noise because she turned to look at me. Her eyes went wide, and for once she was the one who was at a loss for words.
I heard you were in some trouble, I said nonchalantly, so I thought I'd come and help.
Her eyes went wide for a moment, then narrowed.
You're lying,
she said with a wry twist to her lips.
I am, I admitted, but it's a pretty lie.
I took a step into the room and closed the door softly. I would have come if I'd known.
Anyone can make the trip after they get the news, she said dismissively. It takes a special sort of man to show up when he doesn't know there's trouble.
She sat up and turned to face me, swinging her legs over the side of the bed. Now that I looked more closely, I noticed that she had a bruise high on one temple in addition to the bandage on her arm. I took another step towards her.
Are you all right? I asked. No, she said bluntly. But I could be a damn sight worse off.
She came to her feet slowly, as if she was unsure how steady she would be. She took a cautious step or two, and seemed more or less satisfied.
Right. I can walk. Let's get out of here.
Chapter 72 Bororil.
Denna turned left instead of right as she came out of her room. At first I thought she was disoriented, but when she came to a back stairway, I saw she was actually trying to leave without heading through the tap room. She found the alley door, but it was locked fast. So we headed out of the front. As soon as we entered the tap room, I was pointedly aware of everyone's attention on us. Denna made a beeline for the front door, moving but with the slow determination of a storm cloud. We were almost out when the man behind the bar called out,
Oi, hey, now!
Denna's eyes flickered to the side. Her mouth made a thin line, and she continued her walk to the door as if she hadn't heard.
I'll deal with him, I said softly. Wait for me, I'll be out in just a second.
I walked over to where the barman stood scowling.
That your cousin, then?
He asked.
Has the constable said you can go?
I thought you didn't want to know anything about it, I said.
I surely don't, for she's had use of the room and meals, and I had the doctor out to patch her up.
I gave him a hard look.
If there's a doctor in this town worth more than a halfpenny, then I'm the king of Vint.
I'm out half a talent and all, he insisted. Bandages ain't free, and I had a woman by to sit with her, waiting for her to wake up.
I doubted very much that he was out half that, but I certainly didn't want trouble with the constable. In truth, I didn't want any sort of delay. Given Denner's tendencies, I was worried that if I lost sight of her for more than a minute, she would disappear like morning fog. I took 5 jots from my purse and scattered them onto the bar.
Knackers profit from a plague, I said scathingly, and left.
I felt a ridiculous amount of relief when I saw Denner waiting outside, leaning against the horse post. Her eyes were closed, and she had her face tilted towards the sun. She sighed contentedly and turned towards the sound of my approaching footsteps.
Was it that bad? I asked.
They were kind enough at first, Denna admitted, gesturing with her bandaged arm, but this old woman kept checking in on me. She frowned and brushed her long black hair back, giving me a clear view of the purpling bruise that spread from her temple all the way back to her hairline.
You know the type, some tight-laced spinster with a mouth like a cat's arse.
I burst out laughing,
and Denna's sudden smile was like the sun peering from behind a cloud. Then her face grew dark again as she continued. She kept giving me this look, like I should have had the decency to die with all the other folk, like all this was my fault. Denna shook her head. But she was better than the old men. The constable put his hand on my leg, she shuddered. Even the mayor came, clucking over me like he cared, but he was only there to badger me with questions. What were you doing there? What happened? What did you see? The scorn in Denna's voice made me bite back my own questions so quickly that I almost caught my tongue between my teeth. It's my nature to ask questions, not to mention that the whole purpose of this mad dash into the foothills was to investigate what had happened. Still, the tone of Denna's voice made it clear she was in no mood to give answers right now. I shrugged my travel sack higher up onto my shoulder, and something occurred to me.
Wait, your things, you left them all back in your room.
Denna hesitated for a heartbeat.
I don't think anything of mine was there, she said, as if the thought hadn't even occurred to her before. Are you sure you don't want to go back and check?
She shook her head firmly.
I leave where I'm not welcome, she said matter-of-factly. Everything else I can make up along the way.
Denna started to walk down the street, and I fell in beside her. She turned onto a narrow side street, heading west. We passed an old woman hanging a shambleman made of oat sheaves. It wore a crude straw hat and a pair of sackcloth pants.
Where are we headed? I asked. I need to see if my things are out at the Morthen farm, she said. After that, I'm open to suggestions. Where were you planning to go before you found me?
Honestly, I was heading out to the Morthen farm myself. Denna gave me a sideways look.
Fair enough. It's only about a mile out to the farm. We can be there and still have plenty of light.
The land around Trebon was rough, mostly thick forest broken by stretches of rocky ground. Then the road would round a corner, and there would be a small, perfect field of golden wheat tucked among the trees or nestled into a valley surrounded by dark stone bluffs. Farmers and hands dotted the fields, covered in chaff and moving with the slow weariness that comes from knowing half the day's harvest was still to come. We'd only been walking a minute when I heard a familiar thump of hooves behind us. I turned to see a small open-topped cart bumping slowly up the road. Denna and I stepped off into the scrub as the road was barely wide enough for the cart. A bone-weary farmer eyed us suspiciously from where he sat, hunched over the reins.
We're heading to the Morthen farm, Denna called out as he came closer. Would you mind if we caught a ride?
The man eyed us grimly, then nodded towards the back of the cart.
I'm heading past Old Borrowhill. You'll have to make your own way from there.
Denna and I clambered on and sat facing backwards on the clapboard with our feet dangling over the edge. It wasn't much faster than walking, but we were both glad to be off our feet. We rode in silence. Denna obviously wasn't interested in discussing things in front of the farmer, and I was glad to have a moment to think things over. I had planned on telling whatever lies were necessary to get the information I wanted from the witness. Denna complicated things. I didn't want to lie to her, but at the same time, I couldn't risk telling her too much. The last thing I wanted to do was convince her I was crazy with wild stories of the Chandrian. So we rode in silence. It was nice just being near her. You wouldn't think a girl in bandages with a blackened eye could be beautiful, but Denna was. Lovely as the moon, not flawless perhaps, but perfect. The farmer spoke up, breaking my reverie.
Here's Borrowhill.
I looked around for the rill, but couldn't see it. Which was a shame, as I wouldn't mind a cool drink or a bit of a wash. Hours of hard riding had left me sweaty and smelling of horse. We thanked the farmer and hopped off the back of the cart. Denna led the way along the dirt track that wound back and forth up the side of the hill between the trees and the occasional outcrop of worn dark stone. Denna seemed steadier than when we'd left the tavern, but kept her eyes on the ground, choosing her steps with deliberate care, as if she didn't quite trust her balance. A sudden thought came to me.
I got your note, I said, pulling the folded piece of paper out of a pocket in my cloak. When did you leave it for me? Nearly 2 span ago,
I grimaced. I only got it last night, she nodded to herself.
I worried about that when you never showed up. I thought it might have fallen out or got wet so you couldn't read it.
I just haven't used the window lately, I said.
Denner shrugged nonchalantly.
Silly of me to assume you would, really.
I tried to think of something to add, something that would explain what she might have seen when Fela had given me my cloak in the Aeolian. I couldn't think of anything.
I'm sorry I missed our lunch.
Denner looked up, amused.
Diok said you were caught in a fire or something, told me you looked positively wretched.
I felt wretched, I said, more from missing you than from the fire. She rolled her eyes.
I'm sure you were terribly distraught.
You did me a favour, in a way, while I was sitting there, alone, pining away.
I said I was sorry. An older gentleman introduced himself to me.
We talked, got to know each other. She shrugged and looked sideways at me, almost bashfully.
I've been meeting with him ever since. If things continue smoothly, I think he'll be my patron before the year is out.
Really? I said, relief splashing over me like cold water. That's wonderful and long overdue. Who is he? She shook her head, her dark hair falling down around her face.
I can't say. He's obsessed with his privacy. He wouldn't tell me his real name for more than a span. Even now, I don't know if the name he's given me is real.
If you're not sure who he really is, I said slowly, how do you know he's a gentleman? It was a foolish question. We both knew the answer, but she said it anyway.
Money, clothes, bearing, she shrugged. Even if he's only a wealthy merchant, he'll still make a good patron.
But not a great one. Merchant families don't have the same stability.
And their names don't carry the same weight.
She finished with another knowing shrug.
Half a loaf is better than none, and I'm tired of having no loaf at all, she sighed. I've been working hard to reel him in, but he's so dodgy. We never meet in the same place twice, and never in public. Sometimes he'll set up a meeting and never even show up for it. Not that that's anything new in my life.
Denner staggered as a rock shifted under her foot. I grabbed for her, and she caught hold of my arm and shoulder before she fell. For a moment we were pressed against each other, and I was very aware of her body against mine as she took a moment to balance herself. I steadied her, and we moved apart. But after she regained her footing, she kept her hand resting lightly on my arm. I moved slowly as if a wild bird had landed there, and I was desperately trying to avoid startling it into flight. I considered putting my arm around her, partly for support and partly for other more obvious reasons. I quickly discarded the idea. I still remember the look on her face when she mentioned the constable touching her leg. What would I do if she had a similar response to me? Men flocked around Denner, and I knew from our conversations how tiresome she found them. I couldn't bear the thought of making the same mistakes they made simply because I didn't know any better. It was better not to risk offending her. Better to be safe. As I've said before, there is a great difference between being fearless and being brave. We followed the path as it doubled back on itself, continuing up the hill. All was silent, except for the wind moving in the tall grass.
So he's secretive?
I prompted gently, worried that the silence would soon become uncomfortable.
Secretive doesn't cover it by half, Denner said, rolling her eyes. Once a woman offered me money for information about him. I played dumb, and later, when I told him about it, he said it had been a test to see how much I could be trusted. Another time, some men threatened me. I'm guessing that was another test.
The fellow sounded rather sinister to me, like a fugitive from the law or someone hiding from his family. I was about to say so when I saw Denner looking at me anxiously. She was worried, worried that I would think less of her for pandering to the whimsy of some paranoid lordling. I thought about my talk with Dion, about the fact that hard as my lot was, hers was undoubtedly harder. What would I put up with if I could win a powerful noble's patronage? What would I go through to find someone who would give me money for lute strings, see that I was dressed and fed, and protect me from vicious little bastards like Ambrose? I bit back my previous comments and gave her a knowing grin.
You'd better be rich enough to be worth your trouble,
I said. Bags of money, pots of it. Her mouth quirked up at the corner, and I felt her body relax, glad that I wasn't judging her.
Well, that would be telling now, wouldn't it?
Her eyes danced, saying, yes.
He's the reason I'm here, she continued. He told me to show up at this wedding. It's a lot more rural than I expected, but...
She shrugged again, a silent comment about the inexplicable desires of the nobility.
I expected my patron to be there.
She stopped, laughing.
Did that even make any sense?
Just make up a name for him, I suggested.
You pick one, she said. Don't they teach you about names at the university?
Annabelle, I suggested.
I will not, she said, laughing. Refer to my potential patron as Annabelle.
The Duke of Rich Money?
Now you're just being flippant. Try again.
Just tell me when I hit one you like. Frederick the Flippant. Frank. Ferron. Foru. Fordale? She shook her head at me as we climbed the crest of the hill. As we finally reached the top, the wind gusted past us. Denner gripped my arm for balance, and I held up a hand to shield my eyes from dust and leaves. I coughed in surprise as the wind forced a leaf straight into my mouth, causing me to choke and splutter. Denner thought this was particularly funny. Fine, I said as I fished the leaf out of my mouth. It was yellow, shaped like a spearhead. The wind has decided for us. Master Ash.
Are you sure it isn't Master Elm? She asked, eyeing the leaf. It's a common mistake.
Tastes like an ash, I said. Besides, elm is feminine. She nodded seriously, though her eyes were dancing.
Ash it is, then.
As we made it out of the trees and over the top of the hill, the wind gusted again, pelting us with more debris before it died down. Denner took a step away from me, muttering and rubbing at her eyes. The part of my arm where her hand had rested suddenly felt very cold.
Black hands, she said, scrubbing at her face. I've got chaff in my eyes.
Not chaff, I said, looking across the top of the hill. Not 50 feet away was a cluster of charred buildings that must have once been the Morthan farm. Ash. I led Denner to a little stand of trees that blocked the wind and the sight of the farm. I gave her my water bottle, and we sat on a fallen tree, resting as she rinsed her eyes clean. You know, I said hesitantly, you don't need to go over there. I could look for your things if you tell me where you left them. Her eyes narrowed a little.
I can't tell if you're being considerate or condescending.
I don't know what you saw last night, so I don't know how delicate I should be.
I don't need much delicacy as a rule, she said shortly. I'm no blushing daisy.
Daisies don't blush. Denner looked at me, blinking her red eyes. You're probably thinking of shrinking violet or blushing virgin. Either way, daisies are white. They can't blush.
That, she said flatly, was condescending.
Well, I thought I'd let you know what it looked like, I said, for comparison, so there's less confusion when I'm trying to be considerate. We stared at each other for a bit. Eventually, she looked away, rubbing at her eyes.
Fair enough, she admitted.
She tilted her head back and splashed more water onto her face, blinking furiously.
I really didn't see much, she said as she daubed her face on her shirt sleeve.
I played before the wedding, then again while they were getting ready for supper. I kept expecting my, she gave a faint smile,
Master Ash to make an appearance, but I knew I couldn't dare ask about him. For all I knew, the whole thing was another test of his.
She trailed off, frowning.
He has a way of signaling me, a way of letting me know when he's around. I excused myself and found him over by the barn. We headed into the woods for a bit, and he asked me questions. Who was there, how many people, what they looked like.
She looked thoughtful.
Now that I'm thinking of it, I think that was the real test. He wanted to see how observant I was.
He almost sounds like a spy, I mused. Denner shrugged.
We wandered for about half an hour, talking. Then he heard something and told me to wait for him. He headed off towards the farmhouse and was gone for a long while.
How long?
10 minutes, she shrugged. You know how it is when you're waiting for someone. It was dark and I was cold and hungry. She wrapped her arms around her stomach and leaned forward a little.
God, I'm hungry now, too. I wish I would have...
I pulled an apple out of my travel sack and handed it to her. They were gorgeous, red as blood, sweet and crisp. The sort of apples you dream about all year but can only get for a few weeks during the fall. Denner gave me a curious look. I used to travel a lot, I explained as I took one for myself, and I used to be hungry a lot, so I usually carry something to eat. I'll fix you a real dinner when we set camp for the night.
And he cooks, too.
She bit into the apple and took a drink of water to wash it down. Anyway, I thought I heard shouting, so I headed back in the direction of the farm. When I came out from behind a bluff, I could definitely hear screaming and shouting. Then I got closer and smelled smoke, and I saw the light of the fire through the trees.
What colour was it?
I asked, my mouth half full of apple. Denner looked at me sharply, her expression suddenly suspicious.
Why do you ask that?
I'm sorry I interrupted,
I said, swallowing my mouthful of apple. Finish your story first, and I'll tell you afterwards.
I've been talking an awful lot, she said, and you haven't made any mention at all of why you're up in this little corner of the world.
The masters down at the university heard some odd rumours and sent me here to find out if they were true, I said. There was no awkwardness or hesitation in the lie. I didn't even plan it, really, it just came out. Forced to make a snap decision, I couldn't safely tell her the truth about my search for the Chandrian. I couldn't bear the thought of Denner thinking I was brain-addled.
The university does that sort of thing?
Denner asked.
I thought you lot just sat around reading books.
Some folks read, I admitted. But when we hear strange rumours, someone needs to go out and find out what's really happened. When people get superstitious, they start to look toward the university and think, who around here is meddling with dark powers, better left alone? Who should we toss into a great blazing bonfire?
So you do this sort of thing a lot?
She made a gesture with her half-eaten apple.
Investigate things.
I shook my head. I just got on a master's bad side. He made sure I drew the short straw for this little trip. Not a bad lie, considering it was off the cuff. It would even hold up if she did any asking around, as parts of it were true. When necessity demands it, I'm an excellent liar. Not the noblest of skills, but useful. It ties closely to acting and storytelling, and I learned all three from my father, who was a master craftsman.
You are so full of horseshit, she said matter-of-factly.
I froze with my teeth halfway into my apple. I pulled back, leaving white impressions on the red skin.
I beg your pardon?
She shrugged.
If you don't want to tell me, that's fine, but don't fabricate some story out of a misguided desire to pacify or impress me.
I drew a deep breath, hesitated, and let it out slowly. I don't want to lie to you about why I'm here, I said. But I worry what you might think if I tell you the truth. Denner's eyes were dark, thoughtful, and gave nothing away.
Fair enough, she said at last with an almost imperceptible nod. I believe that.
She took a bite of her apple and gave me a long look as she chewed, never looking away from my eyes. Her lips were wet and redder than the apple. I heard some rumours, I said at last, and I want to know what happened here. That's all, really, I just...
Listen, Kvothe, I'm sorry.
Denner sighed and ran a hand through her hair.
I shouldn't have pushed you, it's none of my business, really. I know what it's like to have secrets.
I almost told her everything then. The whole story about my parents, the Chandrian, the man with black eyes and a nightmare smile. But I worried it might seem like the desperate elaboration of a child caught in a lie. So instead I took the coward's way out and stayed silent.
You'll never find your true love that way, Denner said.
I snapped out of my reverie, confused. I'm sorry, what?
You eat the core of your apple, she said, amused. You eat it all around, then from the bottom to the top. I've never seen anyone do that before.
Old habit, I said dismissively, not wanting to tell her the truth, that there had been a time in my life when the core was all of the apple I was likely to find, and I'd been glad of it.
What did you mean before? Didn't you ever play that game?
She held up her own apple core and grabbed the stem with two fingers. You think of a letter and twist. If the stem stays on, you think of another letter and twist again. When the stem breaks off, hers did, you know the first letter of the name of the person you're going to fall in love with.